A soft whistle brought him out of his reverie, and he looked down. Matatu was at the base of the tree, 60 feet below where he sat. He gesticulated up at Sean.
"Listen,"
he signalled.
"Danger!"
And Sean felt his pulse trip and accelerate. Matatu did not use the danger signal lightly. He cocked his head and listened, but still it was almost a full minute before he heard it. As a bushman, Sean's senses, especially eyesight and hearing, were honed and acute, but compared to Matatu, he was a blind mute. As he heard and recognised the sound at last, even though it was faint and far away, Sean's pulse pumped again, and he swivelled round in the fork of the branch and looked back northwards in the direction from which they had come. Apart from a few high streaks of cirrostratus cloud, the morning sky was empty blue. Sean put up his binoculars and searched it. Looking low along the horizon, close to the tops of the tall hardwood trees, the distant sound increasing in volume gave him a direction in which to search, until suddenly the shape appeared in the field of his binoculars, and he felt the slide of dread in his guts. Like some gigantic and noxious insect, the hind cruised hump-backed and nose low above the forest tops. It was still some miles distant, but coming on directly towards Sean's treetop perch. General China sat in the flight engineer's seat under the forward canopy of the hind and looked ahead through the armoured windscreen. This early in the morning the air had a crystalline lucidity through which the rays of the low sun lit every detail of the landscape below him with a radiant golden light. Although he had already flown many hours in the captured machine, he had not yet grown accustomed to the extraordinary sense of power that his seat under the forward canopy aroused in him. The earth and everything in it lay below him. He could look down on mankind and know that he held the power of life and death over them. He reached out now and gripped the control lever of the Gatling cannon. The pistol grip fitted neatly into his right hand, and as the heel of his hand depressed the cocking plunger, the remote aiming screen lit on the control panel directly in front of him. As he moved the control lever, traversing, depressing or elevating, so the multiple barrels of the cannon faithfully duplicated each movement, and the image of the target was reflected on the screen. With the slightest pressure of his forefinger, he could send a dense stream of cannon shell hosing down to obliterate any target he chose. Then, by simply throwing a switch on the weapons console, he could select any of the Hind's alternative armaments, the rockets in their pods, or the banks of missiles. It had not taken China long to master the complex weapons control system, for the basic training he had received in the Siberian guerrilla training camp so long ago, at the beginning of the Rhodesian War of Liberation, had stood him in good stead down the years. However, this was the most awe-inspiring firepower he had ever had at his fingertips, and the most exhilarating vantage point from which to deploy it. At a single word of command, he could soar aloft like an eagle in a thermal, or plunge like a stooping peregrine. He could hover on high, or dance lightly on the leafy tops of the forest. The power that this machine had bestowed upon him was truly godlike. At first, there had been serious problems to surmount. He could not work with a captured Russian pilot and crew. They were sullen and unreliable. Despite the threat of horrible death that hung over them, he realized they would seize the first opportunity to escape or to sabotage his precious new hind. One of the Russian ground crew need only drain the lubricant from a vital part of the machine, or loosen a bolt, or burn out a section of wiring, and neither China nor any of his Renamo had the technical expertise to recognise the sabotage attempt until it was too late. In addition, the Russian pilot had from the very beginning made communication between them difficult. He had played dumb and deliberately misunderstood China's commands. Trading on the knowledge that China could not do without him, he had become progressively more defiant and recalcitrant. China had solved that problem swiftly. Within hours of the destruction of the Russian squadron and the capture of the Hind, he had radioed a long coded message to a station 200 miles further north across the national boundary between Mozambique and Malawi. The message had been received and decoded at the headquarters of a large tea plantation on the slopes of the Mlanje Mountain, and the proprietor, of which was a member of the Central Committee of the Mozambique National Resistance and the Deputy Director of RENAMO Intelligence. He had telexed China's report and requests directly to the Director General of the Central Committee at his headquarters in Lisbon, and within 6 hours a crack Portuguese military helicopter pilot with many thousands of hours flying experience and 2 skilled aeronautical engineers were aboard a TAP airliner southward bound for Africa. From Nairobi, they changed to an Air Malawi commercial flight scheduled directly for Blantyre, the capital of Malawi. And there a driver and a Land Rover from the tea plantation were waiting to whisk them out to the private airstrip on the tea estate. That night, the tea company's twin-engine beechcraft made a midnight crossing of Lake Cabora Bassa, a perilous journey that the pilot had undertaken many times before, and a single red flare guided him to the secret bush strip that General China's men had hacked out of the wilderness just west of the mountains of Gorongosa. A double line of RENAMO guerrillas, each holding aloft a burning torch of paraffin-soaked rags, provided a flare path, and the beechcraft pilot landed smoothly, and without shutting down his engines, deposited his passengers, turned and taxied back to the end of the rough airstrip, and then roared away, climbed clear, and turned northwards again into the night. There had been a time, not long ago, when such a complicated route for bringing in men and material would not have been necessary. Only a year previously, China's request would have been radioed southwards rather than north, and the delivery vehicle, instead of a small private aircraft, would have been a Puma helicopter with the South African Air Force markings. In those days, when the Marxist president of Frelimo, Samora Machel, had hosted the guerrillas of the African National Congress and allowed them to use Mozambique as a staging post for their terror attacks with limpet mines and car bombs on the civilian population of South Africa, the South Africans had retaliated by giving their full support to the RENAMO forces that were attempting to topple Machel's Frelimo government. And then, to the dismay of the RENAMO command, Samora Machel and P.W. Botha, the South African president, had signed an accord at the little town of Nkomati on the border between their two countries, the direct result of which had been a drastic reduction of South African aid to RENAMO in exchange for the expulsion of the ANC terror squads from Mozambique. Both sides had cheated on the agreement, with a wink and a nudge. Machel had closed the ANC offices in Maputo, but allowed them to continue their terror campaign without official Frelimo support or approval, and the South Africans had cut back on their support to RENAMO, but still the Pumas made their clandestine cross-border flights. And then the deck had been reshuffled when Samora Machel died in the wreck of his personal aircraft, an antiquated Tupolev, which had been retired from airline service in the USSR and magnanimously given to Machel by his Russian allies. The Tupolev's instrumentation was so decrepit, and on the night of the crash, both the Russian pilots had been so full of vodka that they had neglected to file a flight plan. They were almost 200 kilometres off course when they crashed on the South African border, actually striking on the Mozambique side, and then, by some improbable chance, bouncing and sliding across into South Africa. Despite the evidence of the flight recorder, the Tupolev's black box, which contained a recording of the two Russian pilots' repeated requests for more vodka from the air hostess, and an animated and anatomically precise discussion of exactly what they were going to do to her after they had landed, the Russians and the Frelimo government insisted that the South Africans had lured Machel to his death. The Nkomati Accord died with Machel on that remote African hillside, and the Pumas resumed their cross-border flights, ferrying supplies to the RENAMO guerrillas. Then gradually news began to filter out of the Mozambique wilderness. At first a few dedicated missionaries emerged from the bush to describe the appalling destruction, the misery and the starvation and the atrocities that were being perpetrated by the ravaging Renamo guerrilla armies over an area the size of France. A few intrepid journalists managed to get into the battle zone, and one or two of them survived and emerged to relate their accounts of the Holocaust that was raging. Some of their reports put the estimate of civilian casualties as high as 500,000 dead of starvation, disease, and genocide. Refugees, tens of thousands of them, began to stream across the border into South Africa. Terrified, starving, riddled with disease, they told their harrowing stories. The South Africans realized to their horror that they had been nourishing a monster in Renamo. At the same time, the more moderate Chissano, who had replaced Samora Machel as president of the government of Mozambique and Frelimo, began making placatory overtures. The two presidents met, and the Nkomati Accord was hurriedly revived, this time with honest intent. Overnight, the flow of South African aid to Renamo was cut off. This had all taken place only months before, and General China and his fellow Renamo commanders were angry and desperate men, their stores of food and weapons dwindling rapidly without prospect of resupply. Soon they would be reduced to surviving on plunder and loot, foraging and scavenging from a countryside already ravaged by 12 years of guerrilla warfare. It was inevitable that they would turn their fury on what remained of the civilian population and on any foreigner that they could capture. The world was against them, and they were against the world. Sitting up in the high seat of the hind, General China let all this run through his mind. From here he seemed to have an overview of the chaos and confusion. The entire country was in a state of flux, and always in a situation such as this, there was opportunity for the cunning and the ruthless to seize upon. Of the Renamo field commanders, General China had proved himself over the years to be the most resourceful. With each victory and success, he had established his power more firmly. His army was the most powerful of the three Renamo divisions. The External Central Committee was nominally the high command of the resistance movement, but paradoxically, General China's prestige and influence was becoming progressively greater with each setback that the movement received. More and more, the Central Committee acceded to his wishes. The alacrity with which they had reacted to his request for a Portuguese pilot and engineers demonstrated this most aptly. Of course, the destruction of the Russian squadron and the capture of the Hind had enormously inflated his prestige and importance, while possession of the extraordinary vehicle in which he now soared over the wilderness placed him in a unique position of power. General China smiled contentedly and spoke into the microphone of his hard helmet.
"Pilot, can you see the village yet?"
"Not yet, General. I estimate 4 minutes more flying time."
The Portuguese pilot was in his early 30s, young enough still to have dash and fire, but old enough to have accumulated experience and discretion. He was handsome, in a swarthy, olive-skinned fashion, with a drooping gunslinger moustache, and the dark, bright eyes of a predatory bird. From the first, he handled the controls of the Hind with precision and confidence, and his skill had increased with each hour flown as he came to terms with every nuance of the Hind's flying characteristics. The two Portuguese engineers had taken command of the Russian ground crew and supervised every move they made. One of the Hind's principal advantages was that it could be serviced and maintained in all conditions without the need for sophisticated equipment. And the chief engineer assured General China that the spares and tools he had captured at the lager were sufficient to keep the Hind airborne indefinitely. The only shortages were of missiles for the swatter system and assault rockets, but this was amply compensated for by almost 1 million rounds of 12.7 millimeter cannon shells they had captured in the lager.